Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 138, where we are discussing several works on the relational work perspective of economic sociology by Viviana Zelizer and Nina Bandeli. To learn more about these texts, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Rohan calling from London.
Hi, this is Sarah calling from London.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle in the United States. Welcome to another episode in our continuing series in economic sociology. A lot of the work that we've done so far has been mostly from the embeddedness view. We've had episodes on Granovetter. We reached back all the way back in, I think it was episode 44 with Oliver Williamson. So we've had that part of the discourse pretty well covered. And we have so far had one episode, 117, on the relational view and more of a sociological perspective in economic sociology. And that was Marion Forcott and the value of life and property. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to cover two authors very much at the center of the discussion on the relational view, and it'll also give us a chance to further the comparison of these two views against the embeddedness view. We have Viviana A. Zelizer, who is really one of the key names in the relational view of economic sociology. And we have a book chapter of hers, which is titled, How I Became a Relational Economic Sociologist and What Does That Mean? And that was from a 2012 book. Then we have two articles from Nina Bandeli, who is a student of Zelizer's, or a former student of Zelizer's, but has obviously gone on and become quite a scholar in her own right in the relational view. And so we have two articles from her, one from the American Sociologist titled Academic Familism, Spillover Prestige and Gender Segregation in Sociology Subfields from 2019, and then a 2020 work, Relational Work in the Economy, kind of like a direct follow-on to the 2012 book chapter. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with Zelizer's 2012 book chapter and then go from there, look at how it's how the field evolved in the span of 8 years through the Bandeli's, one of Bandeli's articles. Then we'll go on to a discussion of the two views in economic sociology and how one is sort of starting to become more and more prominent.
Yeah, so for me, Tom, I think I had a somewhat interesting experience because I've read these or been exposed to these in reverse order. So I first read Nina's 2020 piece and then Viviana's 2012 piece, which, by the way, Nina was one of Viviana's students in Princeton. In the 2012 piece, in fact, Viviana refers to Nina and Fred Wary, I think, two of her students who've gone on to build on this work. The reason it was an interesting experience was because it felt a bit more hard to catch a hold of when I was looking at what it has become in the 2020 piece. But seeing Viviana's kind of encapsulation of it in 2012 as well, and maybe I personally also like to fit it within the biographical account of the person, it became much clearer. So let me just kind of give you my thoughts on it from where it all began in Viviana's case. And the sense I get is that it started with her empirical settings, because she was studying things like how life insurance became a thing and the kind of the stigma around profiting off of death and the meaning of those kinds of economic arrangements and transactions, studying economic behavior in household settings. And we'll talk about this more when we talk about earmarking as an example that she gives. But this concept of relational work is something that has come out of these settings that she studied. And like at a fundamental level, she found herself questioning why do we only study economic activity in firms and organizations participating in market activity when you've got so much happening in terms of, you know, gifts, favors being exchanged between relatives and friends and households and other settings. Seeing that background made it kind of a bit more compelling, where one is her biographical background and what she was studying, and second is the background of the field, right? So she draws out how you've got the embeddedness perspective, popularly in Mark Granovetter's writings in the 80s, taking over the field. And then over time, this kind of critique that embeddedness is kind of just a contextual perspective. She calls them context analysts in this 2012 piece, where you're just looking at the basic kind of economic paradigm and then adding sociality as a context. Okay, but these people have repeated exchange because they've known each other for a while, so there's trust or something like that. Or they are embedded in dense networks versus sparse networks. And then Viviana's whole thrust and point is that we need to go further than that. It's not enough to just add context as a factor, but we need to rethink what these exchanges are. And then the premise is that everything is happening in a relational sense and with the meaning of the relationship filtered onto it. So that's kind of the almost the philosophical starting point with which she then articulates her view of what relational work is.
And the actual definitions we have of relational work. So the simple summary says, relational work are efforts in matching social relations with economic transactions and media of exchange. And the way economic sociology considers it includes relational accounting, obfuscated exchange, clarifying and blurring practices, and emotions and power in relational work. This is the introduction on page 251 of the 2020 article. And that research questions that address relational work or that are appropriate for relational work are items that do A, how individuals earmark money, B, how they deal with morally charged economic transactions. Those are some of the contexts that Rowan already mentioned. How they configure social relations through economic practices. That's what most people think economic sociology is overall. How they use social relations to accomplish economic exchange. So that has a lot of those social evaluation mechanisms that we've talked about before, like status, legitimacy, trust, reputation. And lastly, how organizations and institutions engage in relational work. And of course, that's the piece that connects this to our long-running series on talking about organizations, is that this is not just about individuals, but organizations and institutions do this as well. So that is the agenda, that 2020 Annual Review of Sociology article, and that's our agenda for today as well. And if we had more time, or three-part episodes, we would also take on the books, because of course sociology is what you would call a book field. And we're all together, Nina Vandelay, Fred Wary, and Viviana Zelliger together edited a book called Money Talks, which comes from Princeton University Press. And this is an edited collection with even more focusing on the transaction side or the currency side, with essays about the meaning of money, the morality of money, more on relational accounting, credit, like absolutely taking vocabulary from the economic side and using them all the way up to date into blockchains. There's a chapter on blockchains are a diamond's best friend, Zelliger for the Bitcoin moment. So if you like this episode and you'd like us to expand it and come back to this, maybe one summer we'll take on the big project of taking Money Talks to expand our series. But I think one of the important parts about why are we calling this relational work and why is it in sociology instead of management is that this starts in what they call really intimate domain. So it's intimate activity. Some of that really started in the original definition of intimate, so about sex work and how sex workers and their clients, the transactions that occur, whether it's cash for activity or gifts or experiences, how those transactions and what the currency of those transactions is are discussed, their gifts, I'm giving towards someone's rent, I'm helping get clothes, I'm buying clothes or helping to get clothes that I like the person to wear in a very intimate transaction. Another example that's discussed in the essay is about organs and really anything to do with bodies and body part, organ donation after death, sperm and egg donation in fertility from living donors, blood donation, which of course every country has grappled with, blood donation, the security of blood products and how to incentivize more people to donate blood. And of course, Kieran Healy has done a lot of work here, as well as everything he's done for data analytics and data visualization. His actual sociology is really fascinating, and one day we should do a Kieran Healy episode as well. But he's done a lot of work on those kinds of transactions as well. So I think that is why this has not fit in our discussion of organizations before, because the intimate space and the often dark nature of these transactions means that they're not recorded, they're not visible, they're intentionally what they call obfuscated exchange. And maybe that was, you know, as Rowan was saying, he's got the historic background started, or he likes to read them in chronological order. Maybe that was because of what they had to do legally, which is, of course, where we talk about how organizations and institutions get involved. And we've done some work on institutions before. We've also done an episode on Fligstein before on markets, which was episode 123. And that was brought up in this article as well at the top of page 254. So that really overlaps with it. So a lot of this will be at the level of the individual, but of course, individuals have always set up institutions, organizations, and markets out of necessity or in the shadows that have then become legitimized otherwise.
Yeah, thank you for that, Sarah. And I think what we can do is, now that we've got the full background of what this school, this literature stream is covering, I want to go back to the 2012 article and sort of start with more of a tangible illustration of what Zelizer was talking about in terms of what the economic sociology was ignoring. And I'm just going to read off a paragraph from the 2012 piece, which kind of gives a very practical example of what these intimate relations are about and how it affects economic activity. People work hard to find economic arrangements that both confirm their sense of what the relationship is about and sustain it. If you are my casual girlfriend, but not my wife, we don't share a checking account. If you are my patient, but also my friend, I won't charge you, but you might give me a gift. In the world of courtship, couples have historically differentiated among categories of relations: engagement, dating, treating, hooking up, and more, marking those relations apart from both marriage and prostitution. In each case, we see participants engaging in delicate, consequential relational work as they match each of those relations to specific sets of economic transactions, such as varied forms of payment and gift exchanges, and media such as money, engagement rings, and more. This sort of sets up a theme by which in this relational sense, what we're doing is we're taking the qualities of the relationship or the state of the relationship and seeing how it changes the way that people exchange goods, exchange money, whatnot. So to further this specific example, it's not just a matter of what happens, like when you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, you know, you're dating, you're spending money a certain way. And the certain way is sort of depending on the culture, I suppose, you're basically lavishing the other party with stuff, with dinners, with flowers or whatever it is. Your economic spheres are separate. But then once you become married, if it's a single, you know, traditional breadwinner, single income household, you earmark money for the house, the mortgage, the car insurance, car repairs, and all those sorts of things. You're separating the budget into colors of money, which in a single family case is simple and straightforward because there's only one source of income. So there's a way in which the family decides how to spread out the budget. when it becomes dual career, there's even a more complicated arrangement because now you're figuring out how are you combining the incomes? How much of the incomes remain separate to the husband and wife or to the two partners? And that gets more and more complicated because then there's sort of like what I spend for my profession, what she spends for her profession and all that sort of thing. This is the space that Zelizer started to wade in, saying that, you know, the old firm-based, corporate-based view of embeddedness just simply doesn't answer these kinds of questions about legal cases. And that sort of continues to illustrate the shortcomings of the embeddedness view. And that's kind of like the first part of the 2012.
Yeah. And with that, those rich examples in mind, it's a perfect foundation to then dig into a bit into an expanded version of the definition of relational work that Viviana has in this in the 2012 paper, and that then Nina actually quotes verbatim in the 2020 review as well, because it's that important essentially. With these examples in mind, I quote, "In all economic action, I argue, people engage in the process of differentiating meaningful social relations. For each distinct category of relation, so let's say, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend versus husband-wife, to pick a heteronormative example, people erect a boundary. So is this a situationship, a relationship, a marriage? They mark the boundary by means of names and practices, the labels that I just gave you. They establish a set of distinct understandings that operate within that boundary. So what counts as, you know, a gift versus not? What is a checking, joint checking account okay versus not? And they designate certain sorts of economic transactions as appropriate, but other transactions as inappropriate, and adopt certain media for reckoning and facilitating transactions within the relation. I call that process relational work. And by certain media, Viviana means, again, the form of it, right? So do I give, if I've got a nephew mowing the lawn, do I give them hard cash or do I give them a gift card to somewhere they like? The medium matters as well. The definition now kind of makes sense the moment you see these categories coming in. If we think about comparing it with the embeddedness perspective of economic sociology, embeddedness might say that whatever boy A and girl B have been dating for 5 years and they've spent X amount of time together or done X amount of activities. But ultimately, the category also matters. Do they think of themselves as husband, wife? Is it a civil union? Is it because those categories mobilize certain meanings and the meanings make the difference for Viviana and for this view, the more kind of relational view. The other key thing from quote that Sarah had given us at the outset, and that word comes up a lot, is the word matching. So given this worldview where you've got these categories, distinct understandings, what's appropriate, not appropriate, relational work is ultimately matching work. So making sure that you're doing what matches in that setting and what makes sense. And then, of course, it's interesting to think about how that came to be and how those senses and meanings change over time.
But that's also because this is at that intersection of sociology and economics, right? So economics needs matching. It needs markets. It needs ledgers and accountability. It needs currency and units. It needs institutions. So that's why we're using this language. So if you think about matching, right? The two classic matching market examples in economics are marriage and labor, right? So labor is the one that we've studied and talked about the most, especially in this series, because that is about trying to align individuals with jobs that are to their capability and with room for growth, and that will pay them to their value, but not more, because the organization doesn't want to overpay. And in a way, marriage markets are the same way. They are about the best aligned actual and potential, but not too much, because then you have the mismatch between the individuals. The reason that we need the relational work part of this is that for the marriage side of the market, we've added the love, romance, soulmate, Hollywoodization piece on top of what for hundreds and hundreds of years was an economic institution. It was solely about securing land, access to resources, family dynasties, women's security, access to trading floors or different professions and unions. I mean, for hundreds of years, it was a solely economic institution. And in the late 1700s, we had the introduction of romantic love and the idea of a soulmate and holding out for not just the best match in the annual debutante and marriage market season, but in someone that is also a love match as well. And that is a very modern conception of what was underneath and is still in many places in the world powered as an economic institution. So if you accept that, and if you come into the modern interpretation of that, then you need to understand, well, in this new situation, how does all this money and resources flow? And again, I think in many of these, let's keep going with the marriage example, as Tom already raised, in marriage situations, married money is messy, right? And there are different models of how different households do that. Some people still maintain utterly separate finances for everything. Some people and households merge everything. And then there's a sort of yours, mine, and ours mixed model. And this is also true for ed institutions, right? So the law recognizes married money very differently. And for some people, that change is what stops them entering the institution of marriage. Many people continue in cohabitations or in something a little less than that because of what happens to money, post-marriage breakup money, so divorce treating money, and in some countries, taxation. Everything is affected by this, right? So this is the long arm of the institution. And that's and that is, again, the institution recognizing that something different is going on here. But I think of all the examples raised in the paper, marriage is probably the most visible example. So I think if we step away from this matching a little bit and just look at other ways that this works, I think exchange, which is what brings it closest to the models of network relationships and facilitated relationships that we have discussed before. I think if we expand and look at exchange a bit more, the example that I really like in the that is referenced is about remittances, the movements of immigrants and immigrant work and socioeconomic movement of people who have left and restarted somewhere else is a big part of some of these intimate examples. And one is about remittances in the first phase, setting up a new life as an obligation. And then when that person's life has changed, either through marriage or the arrival of children or some increased stability and assimilation in their new environment, they move from being an obligation to a gift, an occasional gift when circumstances allow. And then after that, they move from being cash remittances to, let's say, trips with shopping brought back family, friends, and neighbors, which is an incredibly visible way to see it, right? Versus the cash moving before. So I think this is another example that takes maybe the personal and bodily intimacy out of it and makes it look much more like the economics exchanges and the network model that we've looked at before. Because that's really, it's not just the embeddedness, the reason it's embeddedness. If you haven't listened to our episode 127, when we're talking about embeddedness, we mean position in a network and social relations.
Another part of the Zelizer Art book chapter that I think is also important is that she does bring this relational view back into recasting some regular, you know, traditional economic activity, which was being covered under the embeddedness view. And then an example of that is in the book chapter is discussing perks. She cites a study by Calvin Morrill about different corporations and how, you know, on the one hand, you're, you know, absolutely right, Sarah, the, you know, firms are trying to minimize their costs. On the other hand, there are social reasons why they feel like they have to offer perks to members and make decisions about which people get perks, which in Morrill's study apparently shows the differentiation between top management and middle management, and that the perks are really very, very important symbols. You know, they're not cash, they're services, things like, you know, first-class transportation, childcare at exclusive daycare centers, special office furniture, the corner office, you know, where you are in the building, all those sorts of things sort of add emotional value or social value to the position and further differentiate it from other members of the organization. The relational view does kind of add as a broader sense of what constitutes value, not just in pure cash, but in what comes with or what is also offered as value to an individual. And she mentions some other non-monetary examples, such as, monopoly money. She didn't say monopoly money, but essentially alternative currencies that substitute for money. It's a way of earmarking. So like, poker chips, food stamps, lunch tickets, frequent flyer miles that are substitutes for money. They actually are not substitutes. What would be it? Proxies for money. And then other like giveaways. Nowadays, we're inundated with all sorts of giveaways, like what Zelizer listed was cigarettes, postage stamps, subway tokens, baseball cards, and other objects that have monetary value depending on the social use. Like, so for example, if you are among a society of folks that like to collect cards, those cards have far more value than somebody like me who thinks collecting those things is not my thing. And, therefore it's only worth the cardboard it's printed on.
And I think another element of this 2012 chapter worth highlighting, I'm glad we've covered a good range of examples, because I think that helps to really ground some of the more, at some points, most of these pieces, including the 2012 and 2020 at least, get quite abstract and theoretical, especially when they're trying to talk about their contribution to sociology and the field of sociology. But to kind of ground ourselves in what relational work means and looks like, another element that Viviana Zelizer brings in is the idea of a relational package. And she gives kind of four components or bullet points in this 2012 chapter. It's on page 151. And let's use Sarah's example of the remittances instead of, let's say, the household ones. Let's come back to the economic domains. The four elements of a relational package are, number one, distinctive social ties. So is it my parents or an uncle or my grandparents or my best friend back home I'm remitting money to? That might mean different things. Number two is a set of economic transactions. So again, is it I'm sending money back or am I supporting them in paying their bills back home, for example? Number three out of four is media for those economic transactions. Again, media as in the plural of medium. So how am I doing it? Am I couriering gifts and kind of products that maybe they don't get back home from my current marketplace? Am I sending cash? Am I sending dollars because for exchange rate reasons and being more technical about it? That's the media. And then fourth out of four is negotiated meanings. Even if I'm, let's say, from Indian culture and the, let's say, category one, distinctive social ties, it's parents. Category two, set of economic transactions. We're talking about remittances. Category three, media for the transaction. We're talking about cash. There might still be differences in category four, the negotiated social meanings between me and my parents based on how we grew up, based on how they grew up. We are still a distinct family within the cultural milieu of middle-class Indians, for example. So these four things together and the connections between them make up what Viviana Zelizer calls a relational package. And that gives you us some kind of analytical traction over studying the relational work that people do.
It sort of leads me to a question of sources of tension as well as to whether or not you send back as much as they think they should be getting and other points of discussion.
And the other thing that this relational package brings out to me at least is how this is kind of meso level, or at least it's influenced by micro macro, because and in the 2020 chapter, we see how it's, there might be a bit of economic efficiency arguments going on. Do I send dollars or rupees or whatever? There might be broader cultural norms. So in my culture, you support your parents and the elderly, but there will still be negotiated meanings at the meso level of me and my parents or my family. And that's kind of where this theory or this perspective, let's say, sits.
Yeah, I also have remittance in my situation. And there's also comparative, negotiated meetings. So like if you have multiple siblings sending money back at different amounts or for different purposes or whatever, it can be messy.
And I would like to just, I think, maybe take a step back, as I said, in case listeners have not listened to our bit on the embeddedness and networks perspective, because actually on page 255 of the 2020 essay, The last paragraph in the first section says, embeddedness is a very broad conceptual framework and open to many interpretations. In particular, the Polanyian variant of economic embeddedness does not share most of the basic assumptions of the network embeddedness perspective. And she cites her own 2015 paper here. According to Polanyi in 1957, embeddedness refers to the co-constitution of the economic with the social. Hence, if an analyst investigation of embeddedness departs from the analytically autonomous economy and society and slips away from the bounded rationality tenet, then the rift between embeddedness and relational work can be bridged. On the whole, these conceptual considerations underscore that economic sociologists working across various empirical sites with different methodological tools would be well served to clarify their basic assumptions about the economy-society relation and the theory of economic action that they bring to bear in analyses. So that is a lesson for all of us researchers in any discipline, and we know we have many students who listen to this series, which is to say, start from your basic principles. Yes, you're disciplined, but maybe if you're in something like business or management or org theory, which isn't one of the canonical training disciplines, if you start with economics or if you start with sociology, stand up and say, what are your assumptions about how people work, how markets work, how money goes round, how work happens, how value is defined? State all of those assumptions and your theory of economic action before you start. Then you can be a methodological pluralist and match the right method to the right question at any time and try as many methods as work in your context. But overall, we are not as far apart as the two perspectives might like you to think that they are, and that the distinction that kept them away for so long was probably this bounded rationality idea. And I love this for us because I think this allows us to say, we can be an economic sociologist even if we weren't trained that way, because now we are all coming back to it from our own way. And I think it helps understand, yes, if you were trained in network methods, or maybe you started as a physicist and you see everything as a network, that you need the pipes and prisms, which we've talked about before, the channels, the gatekeeping, all of that is how you see the world. But you need another level that says, what is your assumption of why people come together in a society, right? That Leviathan or not definition. What is your assumption of why we have money? You know, why don't we just do things because it's good for each other? The Tragedy of the Commons meets Eleanor Ostrom, right? All of these core theories that we've talked about in multiple episodes before, this says confront them, define them, plant your flag, and then we can all move on and understand the context from your point of view. And I think that is a wonderful reminder of theory building and world building, because it's really hard. I think even, you know, Rowan, you're the one of us who has been most recently through this. But even if you have the very best theory training in your program, which you did, that is the hardest part of all of it. Like, the stats is hard, and getting unique data and saying something interesting and finding a contribution, all of that is hard. But I personally find this bit about piecing together the theories from all the different sources you've ever read and keeping track who said what and making them talk to each other, I find this part the hardest, no matter what you're training.
Yeah, and that, by the way, is a good segue to bring in the 2019 paper. Like I said in the before, Zelizer is using the book chapter as sort of like a springboard to say this is why we need this other perspective, why we need the relational view, because there's so much that the embeddedness view doesn't explain. There's weaknesses, there's gaps, there's anomalies that need to be addressed. But that's not to say that the embeddedness view was wrong. It was built around a particular set of questions. And as those types of questions, they get answered, or if new questions come up, then naturally, you know, okay, we have some new ideas. How do we bridge the two? But also, what makes the old ideas so difficult to unseat? Take all of these works at face value. The relational view should be much further along in, say, unseating or integrating with the rest of the embeddedness view more than it has, at least as of 2020. But there's still tension in that the embeddedness view was still very heavily entrenched despite its known shortcomings and despite the growing work in the relational school. Her article is oriented on trying to come up with why is that the case. And what she came up with is the name of the article sort of explains it. Academic Familism, Spillover Prestige, and Gender Segregation in Sociology Subfields was the title. And what she's doing here is she's talking about, well, it's having trouble unseating or getting attention in the business schools or in other, in academia more generally, question being why. Academic Familism is basically the case of intergenerational reinforcement. That is, a senior academic has students. The students continue the work of the senior academic. They themselves become senior academics embedded within this school of thought, and it perpetuates and perpetuates, which basically further entrenches one particular school in the academic environment and becomes more and more difficult to unseat. So that's the first point. The second point of spillover prestige is where, in this case, economic sociology, Vandeley claims, is when the economists saw economic sociology as an opportunity, the prestigious economists are the ones who came over. And so then that sort of legitimized a particular view of a economic-dominated economic sociology, because the prestige being brought in was brought in from an outside field. And so other fields are having difficulty being able to overcome that because it was sort of like an advantage that has led to the embeddedness view being very deeply entrenched in the academic environment, if that makes sense. And I hope I'm capturing that argument correctly. What this brings in is to the discussion of, all right, the evolution of the science or a scientific field of where an old paradigm is being challenged, but the new paradigm hasn't quite beaten back the old paradigm quite enough. And so what Vandeley is doing is trying to lay this out. And
I agree, but also I think part of this sort of Princeton School of Economic Sociology is that we don't have to beat it back. We just have to recognize when do we need one and when do we need the other, right? So the embeddedness approach, I think, will help us in. So there's a section on page 258 called Making Emotions and Power Visible. Of course, I'm going to be the one in the team to bring up that section, right? But there's a piece that says, and this is Vandeley talking about herself. Vandeley suggested that how complex and visible unscripted relational work is will depend on the extent of the uncertainty of situations, ambiguity in expectations about the outcome or variable goals across parties engaged in relational work, and potential misunderstandings about appropriate media of exchange, but also challenges to power positions and interventions by third parties, broader sets of relations or institutions in which partners to an exchange are situated. So there are two levels that we can understand this paragraph at. The first level to bring up here in relation to what you said, Tom, is this latter part, which is interventions by third parties, brokers, broader sets of relations, and institutions in which partners to an exchange are situated. The situation of individuals is the network perspective, is embeddedness, right? So we don't have to set them up in a gladiatorial way. They need to speak to each other, and relational work speaks to embeddedness. It's the other way that doesn't speak back as much. But we don't need to set them up that way. But the first part about this uncertainty, right? This has been a large part of my work for many years, which is about social status. And status functions as a signal in situations of uncertainty. If everything is burning down around you, you use status and status hierarchies to figure out who to listen to. And hopefully that status hierarchy will be organized by expertise. If you need someone for information uncertainty, hopefully it would be organized by power and resources. If you need someone for economic uncertainty, they have a basis to them, but the main basis is about the signaling in conditions of uncertainty. And so for me, this is the main reason that I am attracted to looking at economic sociology and looking today, or I wanted us to talk about relational work. is that this is yet another way of looking at how do people manage uncertainty. One of the ways they do that is to fall back on their social relations in these intimate transactions or in these intimate markets, in a way. They fall back on their social relations either when the non-social institutions or the more canonical institutions have either failed them or in lack of them. And I think those are the two pieces that is what connects this to all of our work on organization so far, is that we have mostly, not just we on this series, but we in the field mostly look at successful organizations. There are a number of core examples where we can learn from failure, and Carl Weick, you know, was the beginning of the way of learning from failure. But until then, we mostly look at survivorship bias, right? We mostly look at how to learn from success and how to learn from certainty and when the market functions the way it's supposed to, right? But what's interesting and fun and teaches us about our mechanisms and our boundaries and our problems is when those things don't work the way they're supposed to. And this is another tool in the toolbox, in the social science toolbox, in the related theories toolbox for these situations of complexity and uncertainty.
Also on the topic of what you were saying, Tom, on kind of Viviana Zelizer's own perspective, let's say that this the embeddedness view seems to have a remarkable stickiness compared to the relational work view. I agree completely with what you were saying, Sarah, that it doesn't have to be gladiatorial, but just it's interesting even from a kind of the sociology of sociology perspective, which is what I guess she's trying to bring out with the concepts of the intergenerational status spillovers and the kind of closeness to the field of economics. But there's also an idea there of just how hard paradigms are to knock over. And this is something that was already expressed in her 2012 piece, where she actually quotes Pierre Bourdieu talking about looking for better explanations of the economy and kind of because people have for even longer than complaining about the embedded view, people have been complaining about the kind of neoclassical economic view and the rational actor model and things like that. And she quotes Pierre Bourdieu, who's talking about a famous thing from History of Science, where Bourdieu says, strategies aimed at correcting the errors or omissions of a paradigm without challenging the paradigm itself remind me of Tycho Brahe, who was a Danish astronomer, remind me of Tycho Brahe's heroic efforts to save Ptolemy's geocentric model from the Copernican Revolution. So that's kind of a famous example that Thomas Kuhn, who we've done an episode on, talks about in his Structure of Scientific Revolutions. But the idea that there were all these added complexities, like the concept of epicycles of planets, to try to kind of explain more and more phenomena while and fit new evidence while still sticking to the geocentric Ptolemaic view. And so in the view of Zelizer and her colleagues, that's kind of what the embeddedness view is. It's like you trying to add epicycles to your solar system model rather than just shifting the paradigm. But then again, by definition, paradigm shifts are harder to achieve. The other factor that, and this is kind of more of my added opinion, is that it's also challenging just because the benefit that the embeddedness approach has is the social network method, which makes it kind of tractable, and there's a kind of easy way now for people to go ahead and study it, run surveys, roster surveys, draw social networks, do your kind of analysis. And it fits, even if it challenges the neoclassical economic view, it still fits a more reductionist and category-based view, which we prefer in the current kind of more quantitatively minded social sciences. Whereas the relational work view by definition is about how everything is co-constituted and it's hard to separate out and study quantitatively. In fact, in what was a great criticism of embeddedness in this 2012 piece, which I will quote shortly, but that criticism also shows you why the embeddedness perspective has a bit more of that reductionism that helps you measure and build a whole field of PhD scholars and test hypotheses. The criticism she quotes is, when authors state that economic facts are embedded in the social, they suppose that there is something we can identify as economic which at the same time can be distinguished from the social. So just because you're saying that economic things are action is embedded in social, by saying it, you are making that distinction. And then I quote once again, in a way, they, the embeddedness sociologists, in a way, they are themselves drawing the boundary they are trying to question, which for me was a devastatingly kind of pithy critique. But correct. So like, while defining it as, okay, economic action is embedded in social context, you are repeating those words, economic and social, and creating that distinction, which for relational work is a critique. And if you'll see the definitions we talked about earlier in this episode, they're not bringing, you know, she's not calling it relational work in economic behavior or in economic, you know, it's trying to keep it as a combined whole. But at the same time, you can see why that makes it easier to study. Now you've got economic variables, you've got social variables, and you bring them together to look at interaction effects and see what happens.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.